It is Ryan here, and I have a question for you. What do you do when you win? Like, are you a fist pumper, a woo-hooer, a hand clapper, a high-fiver? I kind of like the high-five, but if you want to hone in on those winning moves, check out Chumba Casino. At ChumbaCasino.com, choose from hundreds of social casino-style games for your chance to redeem serious cash prizes. There are new game releases weekly, plus free daily bonuses, so don't wait. Start having the most fun ever at ChumbaCasino.com. No purchase necessary. VGW. Void or prohibited
by law. See terms and conditions. 18 plus. With Lucky Land Slots, you can get lucky just about anywhere.
This is your captain speaking. We've got clear runway and the weather's fine, but we're just going to circle up here a while and get lucky. No, nothing like that. It's just these cash prizes add up quick. So I suggest you sit back, keep your tray table upright, and start getting lucky.
Play for free at LuckyLandSlots.com. Are you feeling lucky? No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
From out of the depths of my soul, there arises a certain fear. What if I should die within the next year?
These are the lasting words of a dead girl. A girl brutally, violently killed at 16 years old.
And he came down and he just was screaming, "Murder, murder." That was the beginning of our nightmare.
It was the kind of crime that sends shockwaves of fear over a neighborhood.
Beverly Jarris's murder has gone unsolved for 53 years.
The kind of murder that brought comments from officials normally hardened by violent death.
It took the innocence out of the city.
And it was brutal.
53 years since someone strangled and stabbed the girl 40 times in her Garfield Heights bedroom.
Well, it just defined my whole life and my parents' lives.
A bedroom shared with her sister Carol, just 12 years old at the time.
It's the first thing I ever think of, even now, when I wake up, and it's the last thing I think of before I go to bed.
Their mother died on Valentine's Day this year, never having the answers she so desperately wanted. Who killed Beverly Jarris?
Well, I just think that she met the wrong person at the wrong time, and this person was obsessed with her.
For him, I shall never cease to pray. The days creep by with their cell, and I'll patiently await his return until sunset and death.
Police believe Beverly knew her killer. The murder weapon, a knife never found. The rope used to strangle her, bound so tightly that it snapped.
The radio was blasting real loud. I believe that was used just to muffle her screaming.
For the last 16 years, Detective Carl Bagacki has worked the case.
There's over 900 files on this case, statements that have been taken through the years.
They've eliminated people of interest. They've gained people of interest. And yet,
this is like putting one of those 1,000-piece puzzles together, and then you find out the last piece is missing out of the box.
Bagacki believes new DNA technology can help them find that missing piece, narrowing their search down to two main suspects. Men, he says, who still live in the area.
They should be looking over their shoulder, put it that way. They should be careful what they're doing, because sooner or later it's going to happen.
Did they have daughters of their own? And how do they look at their daughters and think about what they did to Beverly? I don't understand it.
And somebody's out there living their life when they should be locked up answering for Beverly. So that bothers me a lot. And, it does get personal, I guess. I mean, it does. And, you would just like to see an end of it. You know, nobody deserves this.
My sorrows I shall never tell. Sweet sleep, come gently with stealth. To all I have known, farewell. I have a rendezvous with death.
Even at age 16, Beverly was a literary soul, constantly quoting Shakespeare, writing poetry in her diary. Her beautifully handwritten words published into a book of poems by her sister Carol. 5 decades after Beverly's murder, nearly every page and every poem mentions death and dying.
It seems like it could be a premonition.
What if I should die within the next year? Life, for me, has just begun. All my dreams would be unfulfilled, all my work left undone, all my goals unreached. My life would have been in vain.
Beverly's father stayed alone in the family home for nearly 30 years after he and his wife divorced. He left every single thing just like it was in 1964, hoping that a jury might someday need to visit. This is a case that will never be closed until the killer is found, a case that will likely take a confession to solve. But if you do know anything, call Garfield Heights Police. They are waiting for that break to solve Beverly's case. Homa Bash, News 5.
Hello, this is Mark. I write a weekly newspaper column about true crime and unsolved homicides for the Claremont Sun in Ohio. Welcome to the Catch My Killer podcast, and thank you for listening. Before I get into this week's podcast episode, I would like to ask for your help. I'm looking for listeners to help support the podcast by buying me a cup of coffee. If you would like to help, please consider subscribing to my monthly crime coffee club for only $5 per month. If you subscribe to my monthly coffee fund, I will share exclusive content with you and eventually commercial-free episodes and extra episodes. And if you enjoy reading about true crime stories, I will share some really interesting ones with you. If you would like to help, please visit catchmykiller.com and click on either the donate link or on the buy me a coffee link. I would also like to give a shout out to Sarah Lee and LaDonna Humphrey for contributing to my coffee fund. Thank you, ladies. And that's enough coffee talk. Let's talk about this week's unsolved homicide. This week's story comes from Garfield Heights, a suburb of Cleveland, Ohio. It was a typical wintry day after the Christmas of 1964. School-age kids and teenagers were all home for Christmas break. Like all of her classmates, a 16-year-old teenager named Beverly Jaros and her sister Carol were just hanging out with friends and spending time with family. It was December 28, 1964. There wasn't anything unusual about the day. Beverly and Carol watched their parents leave and go to work. The sisters had plans to walk to their grandmother's house and have lunch with her. Around 1 p.m., Beverly told her grandmother that she needed to return home and meet up with her friends, Barbara and Margie. An 18-year-old neighbor of Beverly's grandmother gave Beverly a ride home. After Beverly arrived home, she gave her mother a call to let her know that she had made it home okay. Beverly also received a call from a man asking for her father. The caller identified himself as Stephen Stakowitz and said that he would call back later. The police would later learn that Stephen Stakowitz was a fictitious name. Beverly's grandmother also called to speak to Beverly. Their conversation was brief as Beverly prepared for Barbara's visit. Barbara arrived at 1:25 p.m. After knocking on the door, she then heard a thump coming from upstairs. It was like someone was moving furniture. After no one responded, Barbara returned home. She spoke to her friend Margie and told her that Beverly never answered the door. The three girls originally planned on spending the day together. Margie called Beverly's grandmother and told her that Beverly did not answer the door when Barbara had knocked. The grandmother called Beverly's dad, Ted Jaros, and shared her concerns. Ted left work to check on his daughter. He arrived home to loud music playing. He went upstairs to check on his daughter. He found her lying face down and tied up. Someone had murdered Beverly. She was strangled and stabbed at least 40 times. The coroner ruled strangulation as the cause of her death. Nearly six decades have passed since Beverly was murdered in her Garfield Heights, Ohio home. Today, the case remains cold. Beverly's death was a crushing blow to the family. Carol has never recovered from losing her sister. Unfortunately, Carol and Beverly's parents would divorce. Carol is now the only surviving member of her immediate family. She has waited all these years for someone to help her find out who killed her sister. For this episode, I spoke to Carol Bartos and retired detective Carl Bigacki about the unsolved murder of Beverly Jaros.
My earliest memory of Beverly is probably when we were like 7 and 11 or
6 and 10, and every night she'd make up bedtime stories to tell me. As Beverly was 4 years older than me, we were definitely at different levels of maturity. Beverly died when she was 16, and I was still like a little girl at 12, playing outside with my friends and being so connected to what was happening in Beverly's life. Beverly seemed so grown up, beautiful, and sophisticated to me. She loved to write poems and short stories, and her nose was always in a book. She would brag that she could read a book in one day. And the Christmas Eve, 4 days before she died, her two favorite gifts were the complete works of William Shakespeare and a leather-bound journal where she would write all her poems in. And Beverly talked a lot about being a Latin or an English teacher. And as far as like music was concerned, the Beatles just came into being really famous, but she was never into them. She would listen to jazz and classical music. And one thing I remember that makes me laugh is whenever I had friends over, she would change her voice and do her best to embarrass me. And she'd hug and kiss my cheek and pet my head. And all my friends would laugh. That's how I remember Beverly.
I'm really sad for you that you've had to go all these years without your sister, because I know it was just you and her. I have two younger brothers, and I'm in my 50s, and they're getting there, and I've had my entire life with them. That means I can't imagine life without them, because they've always been in my life. It's probably something that I take for granted, but in your situation, you lost your sister at such a young age that you've gone on to have a family. And you probably would have loved to have had her to be a part of your wedding. And you probably would have liked to have had her be there for your high school graduation and all your other family moments. So what has that been like for you? How has this affected your life in that regard, that you've just missed out on so much with your sister? Please tell me about that.
I don't know how my mom and dad ever survived the loss of Beverly in such a horrific manner. I can't speak for them, but as a mother, if this happened to me, I have 4 children, I don't know if I could have survived it. I feel like Beverly's murder was the one defining moment of my life. I had a pretty carefree childhood up to the point of her murder. Like most kids in the 60s, we just spent our days outside, running around with neighborhood friends, playing outside until dark in the summertime, riding bikes, swimming at the city pool, ice skating at the fire station pond in the winter. And I feel like I was a really outgoing kid at that point in my life. But then after Beverly was murdered, I was never the same. And my freedom was pretty much curtailed. I was never left alone at home, even for a few minutes, until I was married. I wasn't allowed to go to sleepovers anymore at my friend's house. Even as a 16-year-old, when I had my driver's license and all my friends did, and my girlfriends wanted to go to movies at night, I couldn't go. From the time that she died, still, I have this huge memory gap. I don't remember much of what happened through those years. I started living again when I went away to college, and purposely chose a college out of state where I thought I would be anonymous. I didn't want anyone to think of me as the murdered girl's sister. First day at college, there was a reception for freshman students. I went to an all-girl Catholic college, Seton Hill, in Western Pennsylvania. And there was a nun who was bragging that she studied all our pictures and memorized our names even before meeting us. I couldn't believe when she looked at me and she said, "You are Beverly Jarrett." And I thought, oh my gosh, I'm not anonymous after all. Through all the years, I never talked much about Beverly and just kept it all inside. It was like so painful to even talk about it. And I've had lifelong friends who didn't even know about Beverly's murder until I published her book of poetry and appeared on local TV stations talking about the case.
It seems that these are matters that I had not even considered. I never thought about the fact that your mom and dad would become so overprotective that they would restrict your freedom because they didn't want to lose their only living child, which was you. That definitely had to have been tough on your life because you missed out on some experiences that she probably would have gotten to have had your sister not been killed.
I also think, like, I'm a mother of four children. How would I have reacted? I probably would have reacted in the same way. I don't know. I tried to give my own kids not a free-range life, but was always like, try to know where they were and what they were doing and everything. But I tried to give them a normal life and didn't want to restrict their freedom in such a way that mine was restricted.
I'm assuming that you told your children about your sister. Did this change the way that they saw the world? You had a carefree life until your sister died. Did they worry more about the evils of the world, or were they able to maintain the same type of freedom that you had before your sister's passing?
I did not speak about Beverly. I had pictures of her around the house, but they were already almost grown by the time I even told them anything about Beverly. But it wasn't until my two oldest children are girls. And so when they were in high school, I told them about Beverly. And my two younger ones are boys, and I'm sure the girls told my boys. My girls would even see Beverly's picture and they go, well, how did she die? They would ask my mom, their grandmother, and they'd say, what happened? And my mom would go, it was just a tragedy. You need to ask your mom. So I just told my girls. And like I said, I had lifelong friends who didn't even know about my sister because it was so painful to talk about. It wasn't until like I published Beverly's poetry book. She wrote poetry. And I actually published it. And that's when my friends knew about Beverly. And some of them were like, why did you ever tell me? I mean, they were like almost mad at me, but it was just too painful.
That's certainly understandable. Now, I read that after your sister passed, you all stayed in the same house. You even stayed in the same bedroom that you shared with your sister, the same bedroom that she died in. Is that true?
Well, it is true, but there were three bedrooms in the house, two bedrooms on the bottom floor and the bedroom that I shared with Beverly. And I would start off sleeping in that bedroom and end up in the spare bedroom. It was just too hard for me to be thinking about what happened. So, I mean, he slept up there a lot.
I don't know if I could have stayed in that room. I think I would have been more comfortable just shutting the door and staying out. Was there a reason why your parents didn't sell the house and move, or did they want to stay to feel close to your sister? What was their reasoning?
We actually looked at houses like Brecksville and other areas. I think my dad, he found her, and I think it was so hard on him when he found her, and he always felt like he wanted to be there if some kind of resolution would be solved and if they needed something from the house. And he stayed there. He died in 2012. So he was there till 2008. He went into a nursing home in 2008. But he stayed there the whole time. My parents were divorced. Oldest son was born and they got divorced. But they were always friends. My father would pick up my maternal grandparents, and then they'd go to Brecksville to pick up my mom, who had a condominium there, and then they'd come to my house every Sunday, unless it was like snowy or whatever. That was for many years, and my mom took care of him before he went into the nursing home, fixing him foods and stuff, and they were very cordial.
From what I understand, it's pretty common that when parents lose a child, the loss will often destroy the family, and the couple will usually end up getting divorced. Unfortunately, it sounds like this is what happened to your parents.
My dad would always talk about the murder to strangers, and me and my mom, we kept it all inside. I had lifelong friends who never knew about Beverly. I think my mom might have talked to some of her closest friends, but basically, my mom and I did not like talk about her, but December 28th and her birthday, October 1st, was always sacred. We'd get together, and even if we didn't talk about her, we knew why we were together. James Bedell wrote a book about Beverly Potts, who disappeared, and her older sister said she could never talk about the loss of her little sister. think it's like there's just some things that are so painful that you just don't even want to talk about to anybody.
With Lucky Land Slots, you can get lucky just about anywhere.
Dearly beloved, we are gathered here today to... Has anyone seen the bride and groom?
Sorry, we're here. We were getting lucky in the limo and we lost track of time.
No, Lucky Land Casino, with cash prizes that add up quicker than a guest registry.
In that case, I pronounce you lucky.
Play for free at LuckyLandSlots.com. Daily bonuses are waiting. No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
Hey guys, it is Ryan. I'm not sure if you know this about me, but I'm a bit of a fun fanatic when I can. I like to work, but I like fun too. It's a thing. And now the truth is out there. I can tell you about my favorite place to have fun. Chumba Casino. They have hundreds of social casino style games to choose from with new games released each week. You can play for free anytime, anywhere. And each day brings a new chance to collect daily bonuses. So join me in the fun. Sign up now at ChumbaCasino.com.
No purchase necessary. VGW. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 18 plus.
For this part of the story, I interviewed retired detective Carl Bigacki, who retired from the Garfield Heights Police Department. He also investigated the Beverly Jaros case during his career. Can you tell me how you got involved in this case?
Yeah, well, this is what happened. When I got hired on the police department, I got hired in 90 and grew up in Garfield Heights, so I knew about the case. I mean, you heard it growing up. And a lot of it was urban legend and some of it was fact. But when I got hired on the police department, the one detective told me, we were going through evidence one day and he goes, see that file over there? That's the Jaros file. And he was showing it to me and I got hooked on it. And me and my one buddy were actually another policeman. We were drywalling a basement one day and we said, hey, we should just start looking into this again. And that's what we did. We started looking into it again. Let's see, I went in the Bureau in 2002. And we were working on that ever since, just off and on, whenever we had a chance, a lot of it on our own time, because we still had a lot of caseload coming in anyways, daily. But, you know, whenever we had a chance, that's what we did. And we ended up taking it out to Quantico. We presented it to the FBI profiling unit. I did a presentation in Philadelphia with top-notch homicide investigators from all over the country. And we tried to promote it and get some new eyes looking at it. We obviously didn't make an arrest, unfortunately, but I think we got it down to a few different people. And one of them came out of the woodwork that we didn't even realize until we started really taking a hard look at some of these statements and alibis. And we were able to tear apart this guy's alibi pretty good. And I told Carol this, too, and I know you had talked to her. I said, you know, deathbed confession or DNA at this point. I said, I don't know what else to tell her. Because we started 40 years behind the eight ball. I don't know. Unless scientifically they ramp it up a lot more and they're able to get more stuff off of what we have, that would be interesting. But case has been a well-known case. Back then, it's kind of like almost like the notoriety of Marilyn Shepard. Everybody knows it changed the whole area in Garfield Heights, Maple Heights, all them blue-collar towns in the 60s, hardworking people started locking their doors. Their daughters weren't allowed out anywhere. It really sent a shockwave through the community. Unfortunately, we haven't been able to make an arrest, but there's people that are an interest to us. Making the arrest is the easy part. It's making it stick is the hard part. So if you're going to have to let them go anyways, you got to make it stick. So that's been frustrating for years now. We had some breakthroughs and then we had some bad days where we thought we were going one direction and all of a sudden it went another direction. But we've had a lot of people look at it. The medical examiner's office was very good with us. Ohio BCI, they looked at it. It wasn't just sitting in a box. We had that case out there. So, but like I said, I would sure like to tell Carol one day that we had an answer for her. And I know she lost both of her parents over this time. We were looking at, and I knew both of her parents, just salt of the earth people, great people. It's just a tragedy they had to go through this and pass away without an answer. I'd like to at least get Carol that, or at least somebody should get Carol that.
Did you spend your entire career with the Garfield Heights Police Department?
My whole career there was like 31 years, yeah.
That's an amazing accomplishment. I wanted to get your take on this case for people who aren't familiar with it. Of course, it's well known in the Cleveland area, but not so much outside the area.
I don't want to get into the suspects. It's still an open case. And so I got to be selective with a little bit of stuff. I mean, there's some stuff I got to hold back just for the sake that if it ever did come to a certain point, then we would need that information. And I can't put it out there. You know what I mean?
Yeah. I'd like to first ask you about the investigation. Can you tell me what happened after the police first arrived on the scene?
Well, they got the call. It was the afternoon shift. Detectives were working. They got a call of an unresponsive female at Beverly's house on Thornton Avenue in Garfield. And when they went there, they met her father, Ted, who actually discovered his daughter in her upstairs bedroom. And then they processed the scene. But back in 64, they didn't have the same techniques or same equipment like we do now. They called in the Cleveland Police Department. Their SIU unit came out and helped them process the scene. So from that day, it was a joint effort between Cleveland and Garfield Heights. Now, I can give you a timeline of basically what happened that day, if that's what you wanted.
Yeah.
So it was on December 28th, 1964, and they were off from school. And Beverly and her friend Margie and her other friend Barbara were supposed to meet up and spend the day together. And Barbara was going to be dropped off at Beverly's house by her mother. And then Beverly and Barbara were going to walk over to Margie's house, which was a couple blocks away. And when Barbara arrives there at the house, she notices the side door is open and there's loud music playing. Beverly loved classical music. There was a radio blasting music from inside the house. Well, Barbara banged on the door a couple of times, no answer. She goes over to the front of the house, which is a typical post-World War II bungalow, and with the dormer on top, which was made into the bedroom. And as Barbara is knocking on the door, trying to get Beverly, she hears a loud thud. She kind of describes it like somebody knocked over some furniture. From there, she waits a couple more minutes. She figures Beverly might be standing her up. Something's not right. She's unsure. She's the new girl in the group. So she gets mad and walks up the street to Turney Road, which is a main thoroughfare through Garfield Heights. And one of her classmates was driving by, happens to see her, picks her up, drives her back to her house. Well, Margie is wondering, where's her friends? Nobody's shown up at the house. So she gets a hold of Barbara. Barbara says, hey, I went there. She never came to the door. She describes what she saw. And Margie is friends with her family, Bev's family, calls the grandmother's house and says, hey, this is what's going on. They alert the father who's at work, and Bev's father comes by. Now, this is already transpiring into late afternoon, about 4:20. He gets home and finds her dead upstairs in the bedroom. Now, there was a series of things that happened that day. Beverly received several phone calls. One call was from a guy saying, hey, your jewelry is repaired. You can come pick it up. Another one was the grandmother called and actually talked to Beverly. And that might have been around the same time Barbara was coming up the driveway, because supposedly Beverly tells her grandmother, hey, I got to go. Barbara's here now. And she also gets a call from a man that she writes down on a piece of paper, Stephen Stackwitz called. It was for the father. They were never able to find this Stephen Stackwitz. They had no clue who he was. They researched it pretty good, but they never came up with the guy. So that all led up to them finding the body. And then after that, the police department was notified and they responded to the scene. And
when I spoke to Carol, she mentioned that her father saw an unidentified man standing outside, staring at the house on the day that Beverly died. He gave chase, but wasn't able to catch him. Can you elaborate any further on this story?
Yeah, Ted Jarrell actually told me that personally. Their house is located on a kind of a side street off of Turney, but it's a few houses from the corner of Turney. And on Turney, there's a bar that sits right there. So there were people coming and going all the time. It was this guy from the bar, I don't know, or Ted kind of thought that the guy might have been in the bar and hanging out or whatever. But there was also one of the neighbors, like 2-3 doors down, that admittedly would watch her. So whether or not that was that guy or not, we don't know. Ted never caught him. But one of the neighbors admittedly said that. So I don't know. But he did say that to me. So that must have happened for sure.
So no one ever figured out who that guy was?
No.
I also understand that there was allegedly a guy who may have stalked her during one of her visits to a local art museum.
They're not sure on that. They interviewed some people, and there was somebody had said there was a shorter, maybe a darker complected male, European type looking male that was looking at her. And one of the guards said, if his looks could kill her, that would be the killer. That's what he said. Now, you got to understand, too, when this happened, everybody and their brother was tipping the police to everything. They had so many guys. People were reporting their boyfriends, their husbands. It was all domestic type situations, and they were trying to pin it on them. So they went through thousands of tips of guys that were either involved somehow or whatever. And then the rumor mill cranked up where a lot of that stuff was just unfounded. That's as far as I know with the museum thing. There was no other connection to that guy except for one of the guards said there was a guy there and he was giving her some really dirty looks.
Carol also told me about an encyclopedia salesman with a criminal record who confessed to killing Beverly. Can you tell me more about that person?
Harry Madoff is by far in the top three people of interest. Okay, there's no doubt about it. Harry Madoff has a long criminal record. He stabbed women before. He's been arrested for that. He stabbed a woman a few weeks after Beverly was killed. He was selling encyclopedias in Elyria, and he stabbed a pregnant woman. He asked to use her bathroom. That's how he got in her house. He ended up stabbing her. He went to prison for that. But when he got out of prison, he was involved in many other crimes, even financial type scams. I believe he's definitely living out of the country, but he was arrested after he stabbed the woman in Elyria. And because they found him in Garfield Heights, his mother actually had an apartment on the street, 141st Street, which is probably about a mile or so from Beverly's house. They brought him in. And you can listen in the interview what he's saying. Now, what he's talking about, when they start talking to him, he is giving a total different layout of the house. He's given different times, different things that happened there. He's not giving anything consistent with what really happened. So that's all they had on him. He wouldn't admit it. All he did say was, he goes, okay, I did it. And even the policeman in the interview goes, why are you telling us? Why are you admitting to this? And he goes, because you guys are going to pin it on me anyway. So that's what he says. They polygraphed them, inconclusive, but I've got a handful of other people that were inconclusive too. So we took this case to a highly regarded organization in Philadelphia that looks into these things, and I presented a PowerPoint to them, and they didn't go for him at all. They went for somebody completely different. One of the suspects that we have that we haven't released, and they went right to him. And they said, this is your guy right here. So Harry Madoff, yeah, absolutely. He's definitely a monster and a criminal and a violent man. There's no doubt about it. And he fits, but you need more than that.
Now, Carol did mention the man that you referred to who was identified by Vidoc. And this man hasn't been publicly named or appeared on anyone's radar. But so far, it can't be proven that he is the killer.
That's correct. They swore by it. And I interviewed the guy. We've done some things investigative-wise where you're close, but you can't be close. You have to be sure, and you have to make sure it sticks. And that's the most frustrating thing. I told Carol, I said, you know, we can go arrest anybody anytime right now, but what good is it? That doesn't mean anything. You got to have everything in a row, and you got to make sure it sticks. And that's the most frustrating thing we've been dealing with. And this guy here, he's certainly not on the level of Madoff as far as a habitual violent offender, but I believe he had reason to do it. He also had access to that house. He was at that house numerous times and a family friend. So she would have opened the door for him. Beverly was known to lock those doors all the time. And she was a very cautious girl. And she would have opened those doors for him. There's no doubt about it. We also discovered a few more facts came to light that point in his direction.
Going back to the encyclopedia salesman, I'm surprised that with his extensive criminal record that they didn't really go after him harder. What was law enforcement's thoughts about him back in those days?
Well, they thought enough to bring him in and obviously interview him and arrest him, but I can't say exactly what the thought was back then, or what they were thinking or what they had. They investigated every single lead, every single tip that came in. And if there were kids buying rope six counties away, they went out to that hardware store to see who did it. I mean, that's how thorough they were. And then Cleveland, too. I mean, Cleveland back in the 60s with their SIU unit just coming together, they were top notch as far as fingerprints, crime scene. That was the best that they had back then. So they had those guys there, too, helping them. But when they interviewed him, I don't know. I can't say because I wasn't there, but I don't know. I wish I had a crack at him, but I don't know how to answer that. I just wasn't there, so I don't know.
Did law enforcement recover any DNA or fingerprints?
I can't really get into that. I'm sorry about that.
I know there has to be trace evidence because I know that the killer brutally stabbed Beverly so many times. And I know from my own experiences of handling a knife that if you stab an object numerous times, it's easy for your hand to get slippery. So most likely, the killer did cut himself and leave some blood behind during the course of this killing. I mean, it is easy to cut yourself with a knife. It actually wouldn't surprise me if the killer accidentally cut himself and left some scars on his hand that are still there today from when he killed Beverly.
Yeah, I wouldn't disagree with you at all on that. But the crime scene itself, and it was a little disorganized. You could tell, obviously, a struggle happened and whatever, but I believe that thud that Barbara heard that she said sounded like furniture was actually, that was Beverly's body falling off the bed onto the floor. And you can tell by some of the splatter and the direction of the blood that that's exactly what happened.
In your professional opinion, do you think that this case will ever get solved?
Well, I tell you what, this is where I put all my hope. Since when I first got in the Detective Bureau, DNA was just starting out to be like the new go-to. And there were rape cases that I worked where if it fit the DNA guidelines back then, you could submit some of the stuff. But I waited over a year for those results. By the time I left, you were getting DNA back minimum of 2 weeks. And they were breaking it down so much. Like, I'll tell you what, back then, when if you had a sexual assault, protocol was you grab the sheets and whatever from the bed and go. Well, that changed right away because with DNA, they could tell you the last 10 guys that slept on that bed. So it was getting so good at picking up everything that my belief is sooner or later, they're going to be able to re-examine some stuff and find some stuff that maybe they can't see right now. That's my hope.
My last question that I have is about the unnamed suspect that you and Carol have both mentioned to me. Is he still alive today?
Yes.
So then that means that there is a possibility that there could be justice for Beverly's family if he is indeed the killer.
Correct. If that turns out to be where there's a few more blanks filled in, so to speak, with this, then yes, there is that chance.
For the conclusion of this story, Carol shared her final thoughts about her sister with me. So I've read several articles about this crime. Let me tell you what I've read, and I'd like you to let me know if the details are accurate. The day your sister passed away, you both had spent the day at your grandmother's house, and then Beverly had plans to spend the afternoon with two of her girlfriends. She then got a ride home from your grandmother's neighbor's 18-year-old son. And then when Beverly's friend arrived and knocked on the door, no one answered. Most likely the killer was still in the house when Beverly's friend arrived. Does that all sound correct?
You're correct about all that. When Barb knocked on the door, well, she didn't knock on the door. She saw the storm door was open and the screen door seemed to be locked. And she heard loud music and she also heard a thump. I mean, I think Beverly was being murdered at that time. Like, couldn't figure out why Beverly wasn't answering the door. So she went to the front door and rang the doorbell. And then there was a magazine in the mailbox. And so she sat down and read it for a while. And then she just went home.
Was there anything unusual about that day? Take me back to that day and tell me what you can remember about it.
I remember the morning of the murder. Beverly and I had breakfast with my mom and dad and my aunt. My mom asked us to clean the dishes from a little gathering we had with our next door neighbors previous night. Every Christmas, there was the next door neighbors. We were in the middle. The three neighbors would always get together and take turns hosting Christmas gathering. But the neighbors onto our left had a sick mother, so they didn't come. So it was only the neighbors on the right. So we took turns hosting. So the next morning, My mom worked downtown Cleveland, so she went to catch a bus, and my dad drove off to work, and we had plans to go to my grandma's for lunch. So around 10:15, we walked to my grandma's house, and we stopped by her hairnet and loaf of bread. We probably got there around 11. Beverly washed and set my grandma's hair. We had lunch with her, and Beverly called her friend Barbara, and they solidified their plans. Barbara would come to our house between 1 and 1:30, and the two of them would walk to Margie's house, another mutual friend. And then at 12:30, when Beverly left, my grandma's neighbor told her son, who just finished a job interview from downtown Cleveland, said, "Drive Beverly home." And so he did. And then Beverly called my mom around 1 about some jewelry. There was this little garnet necklace that Beverly really liked and wanted to get fixed from my great-grandma. The jeweler said, "Not worth fixing." And then she had a friend, Barb Kralik, who called between 1:05 and 1:15. Nothing out of the ordinary. Then my grandma called her, and that's when Beverly says, "Barb is at the door now." And Barb actually got there probably around 1:25. Her mom drove her, and then Barb tried to gain entrance and tries the doorbell at the front door, and also the side door was open, but the screen door was locked, and she stayed around till probably 1:32, and then Barb walked to the main road, and she was driven home by a friend, and then she kept on calling her home, and then finally she called Margie, the one they were supposed to get together at their house between 2:30 and 2:45, and then Margie called my grandma around 4, and my grandma called my dad at work, and it was probably a 10 or 15 minute drive. My dad owned this little lighting shop. I stood on the porch of my grandma's house watching the main road to see when I could see my dad's car drive by, and I saw him drive by, and I gave him enough time, I thought, to get home, and I called home, and he picked up the phone. He goes, "I have to go upstairs. I just got here." And then he came down. He just started screaming, "Murder, murder." And then he called the Garfield Heights Police Department.
I had read that after your dad arrived home, he saw a man standing in the front yard looking at the house. And then your dad chased him but didn't catch him. Did that really happen?
Yes, that is true.
Now, do you think that was the suspect?
I do. In my mind, there's only two suspects that I give any credence to. The Facebook groups, they're all over the place.
Oh, yes. They definitely have their theories.
I know. But in October 2015, Beverly's case was presented to the VDOC Society in Philadelphia. And there's 82 members because I can't remember why. But anyway, the members are forensic professionals, FBI profilers, homicide investigators, scientists, psychologists, prosecutors, and coroners. And these experts come up with one suspect that has not been on the list of persons of interest before. And I can't say his name, but he's my top suspect. And his friends, who were to be his alibi, did not confirm his story of his whereabouts that day. He refused a lie detector test and to give his DNA. Received fingerprints then and now and everything. After I appeared on Fox News 8 in Cleveland, there was a tip that came into the Garfield Heights Police Department that named this person as a person of interest. And he's my top one. But then the other main person of interest is 17 years old at the time. And the only reason I'm talking about him because he has a criminal history. All the other people, they have lived normal lives. They've never been prosecuted or anything. Nothing has been done with them. So I will not name anybody else but this Harry Joseph Madel, a known stabber. And then on February 16th, 1965, that was a few weeks after Beverly was murdered, he was working as an encyclopedia salesman and went to an apartment of a pregnant housewife, Gerda Levy, in Elyria, and he stabbed her in the stomach and chest, and she survived the attack. I look back and I see that Beverly was murdered exactly 3 months after Madel comes to Garfield Heights. He had just been released from Mathis's boys' school in Michigan for raping his stepmother at knife point. And after two attempts to track Madoff's alibi, and both of them false. He had no alibi for the afternoon of December 28th. Detectives knew where he was in the morning and after 5 p.m., but not during the critical hours when Beverly was murdered, and he did confess to the murder, and then he walked it back later. And this Harry guy was working both at Hallie's department store in downtown Cleveland and at Burroughs at Southgate Mall, both of which Beverly would shop at. And he admitted seeing Beverly and a friend on a bus and following Beverly home. He said that it took him 15 minutes to walk from his apartment to our house. And after four inconclusive polygraph tests, Captain Horrigan, who was the chief investigator at the time, wanted to move on, and so he let him go. But Lee Peters, who administered the polygraph and was considered an expert, said he had a hunch that Madoff did something much worse than stabbing that murder lady. And also, there was the famous call from Stephen Stakowitz that Beverly took asking for one of my parents, and no Stephen Stakowitz was ever identified. If it were the killer, seeing if Beverly was home alone, Harry would have been probably the only known suspect whom Beverly wouldn't be able to recognize his voice.
I did see the story about the encyclopedia salesman. Is he still alive today?
Yes, he broke parole. He has a history of scams in terms of financial scams. I mean, he calls himself Dr. Joseph Madoff, and somewhere in Europe, we think in Switzerland or Germany. I have to believe that this Captain Horrigan, he thought he knew who did it. And no one knows who he thought did it. I think he thought it was Beverly's current boyfriend, who was a college student, and I will never believe that he did it. So I think he just gave him a pass. So the Garfield Heights police and Cleveland prosecutors, they tested the rope, and we had partial DNA, and they keep on testing it.
So going back to your dad seeing the potential suspect, did he ever try to pick anyone out of a photo lineup?
No, it was dark when he got home.
Do you ever contact the police and ask for updates, or is this case not being worked without any new evidence?
It's an open case. Unfortunately, my contact was Carl Bagacki, and he did retire in May of 2020. And so they assigned a new detective to the case. He's in his 40s, and I have never met him. He's my contact. Carl always kept me into the loop, and I don't know if there's been any tips or anything else.
Yes, that's why I thought that this would be a good case to share with the public. Today, technology is solving cold cases from 40 and 50 years ago. This is a case that I'm hoping will eventually be solved. It's too bad your parents died without knowing what happened to their daughter. It's also possible that the right person listens to this podcast and can identify Beverly's killer. So many years have passed that maybe someone will be finally ready to talk. You just never know. And if anyone has a tip, who would they need to contact?
Mark Maneri is the new Garfield Heights detective assigned to Beverly's case. And he can be contacted at area code 216-475-5686.
And my final question for you is, for anyone who is listening to this podcast, if they know anything about what happened to Beverly back in 1964, what would you say to that person or persons?
Please tell the authorities what you know so this can be solved. I'm the only one left of the family, so I can have some peace.
And that concludes the story of Beverly Jarosz. What happened to Beverly? Why did someone strangle and stab a 16-year-old teenager to death? What could she have possibly done to make someone want to kill her so viciously? The police have suspects, but nothing that has led to any arrests. Unfortunately, Beverly's parents waited for justice that never arrived. Ted died in 2012, while Eleanor died in 2018. Beverly and her parents are interred at Calvary Cemetery in Cleveland. Carol is now the only remaining family member. If you are listening to this podcast and can give Carol the answers she has waited for, please call the Garfield Heights Police Department at 216-475-5686. And if you are a parent, law enforcement official, friend, or relative seeking justice for an unsolved homicide case, please visit my website and complete the contact form or contact me through Facebook.
Thank you for listening.